And welcome to Chillennial Horrors, the 2000s horror movie podcast where neither of your hosts are actually real people. We are both figments of one another's imagination. But you won't find that out until the end. I'm Sarah and my co-host is Jonathan.
Hello.
And today we are going to look back at four films from the 2000s with a big shocking twist at the end. So that will be Identity from 2003, The Skeleton Key from 2005, Drag Me to Hell and Orphan from 2009. So just as a heads up, we will be talking about the twist ending, so there will be lots of spoilers. So if you don't want to be spoiled for films that are more than a decade old, listen at your own risk. Go and watch them now. So yeah, twist endings. Johnny, how do you feel about movies with big twist endings?
I think I do. I love a big twist if it feels like it delivers on things that are set up in the movie. And I don't mind if it's like a Saw-style reveal or a Dead Silence-style reveal where it's kind of out of nowhere a lot of the time. But I love the over-dramatic montage of here's all the stuff you missed. I like the kind of the sudden music build up, and oh my god, I love a good twist. And I think I also love a bad twist, but it turns the movie from, you know, genuinely really good to something that I love for the outrageousness of it. Like I think a good twist in a bad movie, or like a fun twist in a bad movie, can elevate it from ugh to I'm probably going to watch that again because the twist is so stupid. How about you?
Yeah, I like a good twist. And when you said about the montage, I just was picturing Fight Club, I think. Because what I like about a twist like that is when you go back and you see things differently. So, like, obviously with the Fight Club, like, here's what was really happening montage. It's like, oh, like, Tyler was never really there. Much like us. rather than just being like, here's the scene that you saw earlier, but you're just seeing the same thing again. I think you're right. I like an audacious twist.
Yeah, I think like Sixth Sense has to be one of the big ones where it's a huge twist, but the whole film still works once you know it. And you can watch it multiple times and the logic of it all makes sense. And you do watch it differently the second time. I think Dead Silence, to like a lesser extent, has that.
Oh, Dead Silence twist is good, though.
I love it. It's so good. But you don't watch the entire film differently. You just watch those scenes thinking like, yeah, he's dead. He's a puppet. Yes.
Totally. Yeah, I think one of the films that we're going to talk about today is actually my favourite twist.
Yeah. I think I know what you mean.
Leave that one till we get to it.
Yeah. But yeah, so we're going to start with Identity, which it feels like the peak of... We've been doing serial killer movies since Silence of the Lambs, and we've run out of ways to end these movies. The ending is so ridiculous that it feels like there's nowhere to go really for twist endings for serial killer movies after this. But we'll start with the plot, which is it begins with a last minute hearing for a serial killer mass murderer who's been sentenced to the death penalty, and he's going to be executed tomorrow, but they found a notebook, his diaries, that the defense thinks should be included and should be considered for an insanity plea. Meanwhile, a bunch of strangers arrive at a motel in the middle of a horrible rainstorm. The roads are cut off and they can't get anywhere until morning. It's a classic And Then There Were None situation where they're getting killed off gruesomely one by one and strange little clues keep popping up. So the group of people who arrive at the motel are world-weary limo driver ex-cop Ed, played by John Cusack. There's a sex worker leaving Vegas who's heading back to Florida to work on an orange farm called Paris, who's played by Amanda Peet. There is a cop played by Ray Liotta, who's called Rhodes, who's transporting a prisoner who's a multiple homicide dude, who's played by Jake Busey of Amazing Teeth fame. There's a family, the York family, who have a young son, and the wife has been hit by a car, so she's bleeding and needs medical attention. There's a young couple who've just got married who are really unhappy. There's a famous actress called Carolyn Suzanne, who's played by Rebecca Del Mornay, who's going full ham, which is great. And there's the shifty motel manager played by John Hawkes, who's called Larry. And yeah, this group of people who all feel like, you know, archetypes of a horror movie. People who would, in a film, be stranded in a motel together in the middle of the night in a rainstorm. I think that's all of them. I've not forgotten anyone, have I? That's the group.
There's just the kid.
The kid, yeah. The York kid.
Yeah.
who's silent because of an abusive stepfather. And meanwhile, Alfred Molina is the lovely doctor who's trying to plead his client's insanity plea somewhere else.
So it's directed somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
Why would that part be
happening at the same time? I mean, surely it's just because there's a serial killer on the loose who might be the one who's responsible for these crimes somewhere else, right?
Yeah, maybe. I enjoy that this film has like a few little twists before, like, I guess it's kind of like a small twist, a big twist, and another small twist, I guess.
Yeah.
I hadn't watched this film at the time, so this was my first go on this film. But I think its reputation had preceded it a little bit, because I was like, I don't really remember this, but I have a feeling that the people are all split personalities. And there's something really early on where I was like, oh yes, that is what's up. They say something in like one of the very first scenes with the guy on death row that's a real giveaway, and I can't remember what it is, but there's like a line where I was like, oh yeah, that's what we're doing.
It does tip its hat surprisingly early watching it again.
Yeah,
I think I saw it when it came out, so I was a teenager, so I think I was less like primed to look for stupid twists. I think I knew that it was going to be twisty, but I think one of the things that weirdly helps it is that if you look at it one way, casting Ray Liotta as a cop who's transporting a serial killer is so obvious that he's going to be not a cop and a baddie.
Yeah.
That you'll just spend the whole movie going like, oh God, it's obviously Ray Liotta. Look at him. He's not like full Ray Liotta, but he's, you know, he does quite a bit of shouting in a very Ray Liotta way. I think you see a bloodstain on the back of his shirt really early as well. They show like it's got like a massive bloody hole in the back of his shirt, and he puts on his jacket to hide it. But yeah, I think that does kind of, I think watching it the first time helped distract me from the main twist that, yeah, that none of these people are actually real. They're all part of the serial killer's personalities. And the reason why they're all getting killed off one by one is because Alfred Molina's treatment is working. And he's bringing all the personalities together so that a good personality can be the last personality standing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess we have to take the bull by the horns here and talk about the portrayal of mental illness. I actually didn't think it was that offensive because, I don't know, I didn't feel like they were playing it for anything particularly stupid. Like, there's a way in which some films, even much more recent films, have portrayed dissociative identity disorder that, you know, like, oh, it makes him a superhero. And you're like, not sure how I feel about that. But this felt relatively okay, especially because how they explain it of like, there's been some kind of trauma that's caused you to create these alters. And I was like, yeah, that kind of is how it works. And I'm not saying like, obviously, it's not ideal that it's a serial killer. That's kind of the problem. It's like, yeah, let's not portray people with mental illness as evil murderers. But like, if we allow for that, there was something sort of interesting about it, and it didn't just feel completely brain dead and offensive.
No, and I think I like that a lot of the, like you said, they're not superheroes and they're not sort of over the top quirky. Obviously there's a couple in there who are like, yeah, like Ray Liotta, like the prisoner who's pretending to be a cop so he can get away, but a lot of them are just people. Like, They are archetypes, and I think it kind of works in the context of the twist, where when you're first watching it, it's like, oh, there's the sex worker with the heart of gold, there's motel owner is a bit of a dick, there's like a jumpy dad played by John C. McGinley, and John Cusack's character is like, oh, the limo driver who's soulful and an ex-cop and he's seen too much, and But like they are kind of, yeah, like you said, they're not superheroes, and they're not sort of, I think, oh, just, yeah, I fucking hate Split, but
yeah,
they're not those ridiculous stuttering kind of over the top, like, and they're all like, as part of it as well, like the cast is so good in this movie.
Yeah,
I think that's, and one of the reasons why I love it so much is because this film wouldn't get made with this cast now. I was thinking about it, it would be like, you might get John Cusack playing the lead, but you'd get like Cam Chagande playing the Ray Liotta part, and like some CW people kind of stocking it out. You wouldn't get John Hawkes and Claire Duvall and Alfred Molina playing the therapist.
Yeah, it's a completely wild cast. The one thing that I didn't like about the twist and how it's constructed is how clunky some of the clues are. And like the fact that it's a good cast means that they sell it relatively well, but like there's a really annoying conversation between, I can't remember who it is. I think it's limo driver and sex worker with a heart of gold, where she's like, "What month were you born?" And he just says May, and she's like, "Oh, you're a Taurus, me too." And you're like, "Well, that's not how star signs work. That's not how conversations work. That's not how literally anything works." But you wanted to seed this idea that, like, there's something that connects them, they're the same, without... Because later they find out that they all have the same birthday, and that's one of the kind of ways that we realise that they're all the same person, is when they're looking through their IDs and they all have the same birthday. But, like, so you didn't want to reveal that they have the exact same birthday, but you wanted to slightly seed that reveal. But it's just not how conversations work. I didn't like it.
Yeah, there's, I think, also the bit where the prisoner escapes and he's running, and he's running in an obviously straight line, not very far, and then stumbles across the motel again. He goes like, "What the hell?" And he's in the exact same place. And that feels really early for that twist.
Yeah.
I think they do show that too early.
But like you say, like, they're distracting you from, like, the big twist with lots of other little things. Because even the fact that you know that Ray Liotta's sus, but, like, I couldn't figure out why the prisoner was acting... Because my initial thought was like, oh, like, the prisoner and the cop have switched places. Like, the prisoner has, like, managed to lock him up. But then the prisoner was acting so dodgy that I was like, that doesn't seem like a cop who's been switched. So, like, something else is going on there. And it was, like, a bit more involved than that. So I was like, okay. Yeah. So, like, that's kind of, like, the first thing that they give you is that there were originally two prisoners and they've killed the cop and now that they're like trying to get away with it like this. Yeah, and then you find out about the split personalities. And then like the final thing is that, like, yeah, they decide that he should be given a lesser sentence because of his mental disorder. Because the therapist is like, oh, a good one is in charge now, and this person didn't commit any crimes.
Yeah.
The murderer is gone. And then I guess that's part of it. It's like you're trying to figure out which of the personalities is the killer.
Mm.
So that the whodunit Agatha Christie bit is still sort of in play, I suppose. Because it's not just that, like, oh, none of them are real, so none of this makes any sense. Like, well, one of them is the killer.
Yeah, because at one point John Cusack's character is in the room with Alf Molina and the judge and the whole appeal board. And he comes face to face with the fact that he's a personality, he's a persona, and has to go back to the motel to stop the killer, which he thinks is Ray Liotta, because I think at that point there's only a few of them left. And like you said, the Agatha Christie bit is still working,
still in play. Except in the end, it's almost more of a Bay of Blood twist, I guess.
Yeah.
Actually, having said that, I don't actually know who the killer is in the original Agatha Christie. So I could be taking that from her. But but yes, in the end, you are led to believe that they have cured him by basically merging all the altars into one and keeping, what's her name? Paris.
Paris, yeah.
As the kind of main one. Even though you think, well, that's really, this person is, I don't know how they're going to get on in life when they think that they're like a sexy woman in her 20s, but actually we've seen what the killer looks like, and that's really not,
it's Pruitt Taylor Vince,
the case. But yeah, then it turns out that actually the little kid is the killer. I don't know how I feel about that section. Like, that's a bit like, I guess it's to do with like the whatever the original trauma is that caused the personalities to split. There was part of me that was like, well, I guess the kid would be the original one. I don't know.
Yeah, I think because he saw his dad murder his mum or something, or saw someone murder his mum, and there's a picture right at the start of like a very unhappy boy in the back of a cop car.
A very unhappy boy.
So I think, yeah, that's it. It's like, it's the one who, the oldest one who, but who's the one who's a kid, I think, is the one. But it just, I think what doesn't work for me about the movie is the Alters twist is so big and outrageous and wonderful. Wonderful in a, like, what kind of way. But then the reveal that it's the kid, it's been the kid all along, it's not as good. That's kind of a shit twist for me.
But how would you end it? Who would you have the killer be? You have it be Ray Liotta and have him, I don't know. I don't know what the satisfying ending is. Is the satisfying ending that we resolve all of the other Alters so that only the killer is left, and then we go, okay, now you can execute him because this is the guy that did commit the crimes in the body that committed the crimes, and everything is resolved and tidy now? I don't know.
Or if Paris killed the boy, I don't know. I find if Paris then stops the boy at the end in the orchard, I think this is partly like, I mean, I like the cast a lot, but it's partly a success of the film, I guess, is that I genuinely like some of the characters. And I know that's kind of because I like John Cusack and I like John Hawkes. And obviously John Hawkes is playing a bit of a piece of shit in the movie, but he's very good at it when he's like wanting to be part of the conversation, even when he's tied up because they all think he did it. And he's just still trying to be like part of it. I don't know what a satisfying twist ending would be for that movie, but I find the little boy reveal, it kind of makes sense, but I think it also reminds you of the cheapest bits in the movie, like the body disappearing.
Yeah.
When they pull the car back after I think it's John C. McGinley who gets run over by the car and he's gone. I think that's when it runs out. There's a bit, about a couple of minutes where it really runs out of steam, and then until John Cusack gets snapped into the the driver's seat in the hearing. I think it reminds you how stupid the film is.
Yeah,
because that's a problem with it.
Maybe it is a stupid, trashy script that's just elevated by that cast. And
yeah,
that's the
like
tension
I think it
that
is.
You're feeling.
Yeah, like absolutely, it is trashy, but it's well-made trash. And James Mangold does it really well. I love a motel setting. I love movies where people are trapped in the same place. There's a lot of like noughties and 90s movies that are similar to this that I really enjoy. For I don't think it is good, but like Mindhunters, big fan of Mindhunters. And I maybe remembered like a Stallone movie called Detox about, I don't know if you've seen that one, but the plot is that it's at a detox facility in the middle of the woods in the mountains for traumatized cops who've developed addiction issues.
Oh, wow.
And someone starts murdering them. It's another one with like a weirdly good cast because it's like 2002 or something, but it is definitely trash Identity, but it's the kind of trash that I love, and it's very well made trash, I think.
It is very well made, yeah.
I think one of my favourite things, I didn't realise this, I was reading around it, because I've seen it so many times, Identity, because it is a comfort film, but have you seen Adaptation, the Nick Cage movie?
I have, but a long time ago, and only once.
I think because it came out maybe like 6 months before Identity.
Mm.
But the plot of Adaptation is that it's about Charlie Kaufman, who was supposed to write an adaptation of a book about orchid thief, and he couldn't figure out a way to do it. So the script that he wrote was about him trying to do it while his fictional twin brother, who's an amiable idiot basically, starts writing a serial killer movie script that everyone loves, and it's called The Three. And it turns out the twist that he's come up with that everyone loves is that the killer, the victim, and the cop are all the same person. And there's a whole conversation that Charlie Kaufman's having with him about how did that even work? Like, if someone's chasing someone, and there's a bit someone tied up somewhere, and there's someone being chased, like how are they, like, and they're all the same person, and Donald, his brother, is just like, I don't understand what you're trying to say, like what? But James Mangold said in an interview, like from I think about 5 years ago now, that he's still really proud of Identity and loves it, but he remembered seeing Adaptation before Identity came out and was like, oh no, like they're just going to destroy us. Like,
yeah, oh no. I mean, someone should have shown Alexandra Aja that film. Anyway. Shall we go on to our next film?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. So, then our next film is The Skeleton Key from 2005. This is one of my favourite comfort films, I think. So, it is set in New Orleans. Oh, I said that in a, such a British way. How are you supposed to say it? New Orleans. where Caroline, who's Kate Hudson, is working as a care worker in like a hospice, but she feels like no one really cares about the patients, so she quits and takes a job caring for a man in his own home, which is like a massive plantation. He's had a stroke, he can't walk or talk, and his wife is unable to care for him. She's also very reluctant to have Caroline come into the house, and she's hiding things. There's a locked door in the attic that the skeleton key she's given doesn't unlock, and there are no mirrors in the house, even though there are lots of places on the walls where mirrors have obviously been removed. And I just adore this film. I think I did not know the twist before I first saw it. And I don't know, I think I kind of go through phases where I think that it wasn't a very good twist. And then I watch it again and I was like, no, it is masterful and I love it. how do you feel about this film?
Yeah, I love the twist. I think the twist is the best bit. I like the rest of it. I think the rest of it's kind of solid with a really ridiculously good cast again. But the twist, I think, is so good that it definitely elevates the rest of it. And it's not like the Identity twist where it's like, what? It's like a whole shit twist.
Yeah.
Which, you know, are the best ones.
Oh, it's a nasty twist. Do you know what? I think that's what I kind of like about it as well, is it is a nasty twist.
It is. Like, it's so nasty.
It's a nasty ending of like a real horror ending. So, where do I even start with this? So, part of the deal with the house that Caroline goes to is that it has a quite dark history, in that a couple of owners back, the house was owned by rich banking folk, and they discovered their servants doing hoodoo in the attic, and they seemed to be doing a ritual that involved their children. And so it was a big party, everybody was very drunk, and so they haul their servants outside and hang them from a tree and set fire to them. And it's fucking horrendous. And you kind of think, God, that's really like Violet, Gina Rowlands, tells this story while they're sitting under the tree that she sort of implies is where it happened. And you're like, did no one chop that tree down? Like, this is fucking horrendous. So as Caroline spends more time in the house, she starts to feel like maybe there are ghosts in the house, or she thinks that Violet might be involved in doing some hoodoo herself. She notices some things that suggest rituals are being done, and she suspects that Ben, John Hurt, is actually, maybe he didn't have a stroke, but maybe there's something magical involved. And all along, her suspicions are kind of partially confirmed, partially denied by this nice lawyer, Luke Marshall, who's played by Peter Sarsgaard, who has a very, very beautiful southern accent, and he's very charming and lovely. And And she kind of makes him her ally, and Violet doesn't like the two of them spending time together, these young people alone in the bedroom. What are they up to? I just love it. So, like, to begin with, she's completely like, hoodoo is nonsense, and I'm going to try and do a ritual to show Ben that he thinks he's cursed, but he's not cursed. But maybe if I can do a ritual that tells him the curse has been lifted, like, maybe that will be enough psychosomatically to bring him out of whatever's wrong with him. But yeah, she slowly starts to believe as time goes on. And I'm over-explaining the plot, but it's because the twist kind of requires you to be paying attention, I think. But it turns out that Violet and Ben and Luke are not who you think they are, but they are actually... There's been a lot of body swapping going on.
Yeah.
So Violet is being possessed by the spirit of the female servant from the beginning. Is it Cecile? Yeah. And and Luke is currently possessed by Justify, isn't it? Papa Justify.
I think that's right, yeah.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to find a new host for Violet, because originally Cecile and Justify were possessing Violet and Ben. And they've obviously used Luke as a new vessel for Justify, and they are looking to use Caroline as a vessel for Cecile. And so the original ritual where the servants got murdered, they had actually swapped bodies with the children. So when the evil bankers murder their servants, they're actually murdering the bodies of their servants, but with the souls of their children inside. So they then, as those children, grow up, inherit the house, sell it to someone else, I think. And then they sell it to the couple who are Violet and Ben. And then that's where we are now. And obviously, like, they swap bodies all the way down the line, live in those bodies until they grow too old. And then they swap bodies with someone else. And why everything has been constructed the way it has is because in order for hoodoo to work on you, you have to believe in it. So for Caroline, initially, they couldn't possess her because she didn't believe. But by slowly kind of chipping away at her disbelief, they managed to get her on board, and then she believes. And she actually performs most of the ritual herself, because they've tricked her into thinking it's a circle of protection. So she draws this whole circle and salt and blood and hair and everything and does all the symbols, and she's like, you can't get me because I'm protected. And they're like, who gave you that ritual? What do you think it really does? And that's that. And I love that moment so much. It's so good.
It's so
the
good.
Whole final sequence where they're in the house and like the reveal that Luke is in on it, and you don't really know who he is at first. Oh, it's so beautiful. I love it. This is my favorite twist film. I just think it's amazing.
It's such a good twist. And just that, like, the climax of Kate Hudson, like, screaming, I don't believe, like, into a mirror that Jenna Rollins is holding.
Oh, there's, like, ghosts in the mirror, and it's yeah. Oh, it's so good.
It's just Jenna Rollins going, like, I think you broke my legs. It's so good.
And kind of, like, doesn't really care, because she knows in a minute she's going to be in that body, and she's going to be the one dealing with it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. And, like, I love how... when you watch this film knowing that, every scene means something completely different. It's kind of, I mean, I remember when Get Out came out, and there was a part of me that was like, it's just a skeleton key. Which it is. Except obviously Get Out is more explicit about its racial themes. Whereas I think this one is, I mean, they're definitely there, because the whole point is that, like, this evil white family killed their black servants.
Yeah.
And as a result, they've unleashed this kind of... I think when this came out, I was a bit like, I'm not sure if this film is a bit racist. But having watched it now, I think it is the opposite, in that Cecile and Justify are kind of... trying to think of a way to say this that doesn't involve the word justified. It's a bit too on the nose. But, like, you know... we're in a world where the only reason that most of these people are there is because of the slave trade. And having the hoodoo is supposed to be like a uniquely, like, American magic that only comes about because of the mixing pot of cultures that are essentially created by colonialism and the slave trade. So it really is like these people are taking revenge, and good for them. But it's so just like there's a scene where Caroline first arrives at the house and Violet is kind of saying, she kind of makes a remark about her being skinny. She makes a remark about how she's probably got tattoos.
Yeah.
And you think that she's just being a judgmental old woman. But obviously, when you know, she's sizing her up, like, this is going to be my body. Do I want this or not? And yeah, when you think she's being just kind of a prude about Luke being in Caroline's bedroom, it's actually kind of jealousy because that's her man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's loads of great stuff like that where there's like, loads of like great what are you guys stuff. Doing in there? What are you talking about?
And just the whole character of Luke, like Peter Sarsgaard fucking knocks this out of the park. I love it so much.
Yeah,
and
he's also
another reveal in films that I fucking love. And I know I've seen this multiple times, so don't ask me for any examples, is when a character who you think is like a lawyer or a doctor or some kind of professional, a character like stumbles across their collection of like like how to be a doctor 101 books. Yes. And she finds like the law for dummies or something. Yeah. It's like, oh, he's not a real lawyer. It just makes me laugh. I love it so much.
He's so good, isn't it? Yeah, I love that whole conversation about like, oh, she wanted like kind of, I wanted like a black girl this time.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, you know, they never stay. Just sort of like, yeah, obviously, like it needed to be someone who's naive and like stubborn enough to think like, no, there's nothing to this.
Exactly. It has to be someone who's arrogant enough. And Caroline, it's got to be said, is a dick. She's awful. Like, you find out that the reason she's working in care is because she had failed to care for her own father when he died. In fact, he didn't even tell her that he was ill because she was like off being a party girl and following rock bands around. And while I have some sympathy for that, like, you're in your 20s, you want to have fun, whatever, she's so judgmental. And like, I think there's a way to read the way she reacts at the hospice when her patient dies and she has to take his box of personal effects out to the bin, as like, oh, she's right, these people do deserve more respect than that. But at the same time, like, she's moaning about how everyone in the hospice did their jobs, basically. Yeah. She's like, oh, they just got rid of his body. It's like, what did you expect? She quits her job with like one day's notice, which, nice, Caroline, nice, I'm sure they didn't need you, and takes a job where, I mean, Luke tells her when she's like first kind of interviewing for the job that probably Ben won't live that long, like he's maybe got another month or so. So you're like, so you've quit your job for a job that is going to terminate in a month, like, great. And you've also abandoned your flatmate. Like, are you going to be paying the rent on that apartment? I'm sure you're not. She's just so irresponsible and so short-sighted with regard to like everything in her life and everyone around her that I'm kind of like, yeah, good, you deserve to get got.
Yeah, I don't think I'd read it quite that much, but I've only seen it twice. I think I saw it when it came out and I saw it this time, so I was more watching it this time for like what Peter Sarsgaard and Jenna Rowland's doing.
Yeah, they're up to it.
And John Hurt as well. John Hurt's so good in this. And he says like three things, like three words the whole movie, but his eyes are just, he does such good like rasping and like horrified. Like, yeah, because I think the first time I watched it, I was like, this is like a bit of a weird role for John Hurt, because he's John Hurt and he's just basically lying shivering for most of the movie. Does some like dramatic crawling on a roof at one point. But yeah, it's... It needs to be someone like that, so you're watching him rather than Peter Sarsgaard.
Yeah.
Who just seems nice and boring for like most of the movie.
But then you watch him again and he's just saying all these like old-fashioned sayings and things.
Yeah, yeah.
In this like charming voice. I just, like, you need to watch it again and watch Caroline. Watch how rude Caroline is throughout this entire film. It's very funny. Like, anytime Violet kind of asks her to do anything, like, she is an employee and like she's just like, no. she just like, there's a bit where she just gets in the car and drives off and Violet's like, where are you going? And she's just like, no, I'm going to do some investigation of hoodoo. And it's like, you have a job, what are you doing?
How did he get on the road?
How did he get on the... She's so rude and so terrible. Like, she's such a dick. It's really funny to me. Like, every conversation, you're just like, yeah, I'm not surprised they hate you. Just, yeah, this horrible, arrogant girl, and she gets got. Although there is an implication that they kind of would rather have Jill, her housemate, as the body, as the vessel for Cecile in the end. But I don't think they're going to get Jill. Jill's too smart,
yeah. It ends with Jenna Rowlands and John Hurt in the ambulance sort of staring in horror at each other, doesn't it? And they're sort of being driven off. It's such a good, great twist.
So delightful. I feel like a lot of reviews about this at the time were like, the final twist doesn't make sense. And I'm like, I would like you to watch this movie again because it really, really does.
Yeah, what? It makes perfect sense.
it's so good. and I think I would love it anyway, just because of the whole like Southern Gothic trappings of this just giant house full of spooky things. Like, there's lots of things to kind of enjoy before you get to the twist. So, yeah, I love it. I love this film.
It is good. I think I find it like a bit slow in places, but... just shaking her. No.
How dare you? No, because I like that though. It's kind of like I feel like something's always happening. They're always leading to something, setting something up.
Maybe I need to watch it a third time.
Just watch it purely to see how many times Caroline should be fired from this job.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like this, that's like a bit where she's told, we took all the mirrors down because you see the ghosts in the mirrors. They say, you can have a small one in your room for your use if you want, but we don't want mirrors throughout the house. So she immediately just goes in the attic, gets a mirror and hangs it in Ben's room. What are you doing? It's not up to you to do this. Why are you doing this? Oh, she's such an asshole. It's wonderful. I think it's hard to top this one for me.
I don't know. I think the next one has a fantastic twist. So.
I'm handing this one to you because I hate Drag Me to Hell. So.
Oh wait, I got them mixed up. Actually, I thought we were doing Orphan next.
I switched them because I wanted to save a fun one for last.
Fair enough. Okay.
And not end on me going, I fucking hate Drag Me to Hell, which I do.
Understood. So Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
This is Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell, 2009. It's about a young woman called Christine Brown, who's played by Alison Lohman, who's having like a hard time. She's got a good job and she's got a lovely boyfriend played by Justin Long, but she's a loan officer at her bank and she's vying for promotion and she's being condescended to by her manager, who tells her that she needs to take more hard choices. And there's a awful new competition in the form of Stu, who's like a kind of kiss ass, a conniving asshole, basically, who's probably going to nick the promotion out from under her. Meanwhile, her boyfriend's parents are rude and snobby and are actively telling their son that he can do better. So, yeah, she's kind of looking to make a tough decision and to kind of show people that she's more than they think she is. Unfortunately, the time that she picks to do this is when an old Roma woman called Mrs. Ganush arrives at the bank to beg for another loan on her house, and she gets actively told by her boss, like, oh, this is a hard decision. So she decides to deny her the loan. Mrs. Ganush then begs for the loan and freaks out Christine, which is unfortunate because then Mrs. Ganush then puts a curse on Christine. And things go very, very bad from there. And she's only got a matter of days before an evil spirit comes and gets her and drags her to hell. I didn't realise quite how much like Night of the Demon this was until I watched Night of the Demon fairly recently. But it's a very... Drag Me to Hell is an extremely loud, gooey, splattery, over-the-top, kind of cartoonish jump fest, basically, in a very Sam Raimi way. And I remember seeing this for the first time at the cinema and a bit worried that I was going to have like a heart... I was a student, but I was like, I remember thinking, like, I don't know if I can get through the whole movie jumping this much. Like, I was jumping it. It's so loud at Cineworld, and I jump at everything. I jump at car door slamming. So, like, Drag Me to Hell, there's like a jump scare every 40 seconds, basically. And they're mostly dumb or like mostly kind of like silly, but oh my god, the jump scares in this movie got me so fucking good at the cinema. I went to see it at my housemate at uni, and I remember watching someone leave during one of the really loud bits, and yeah, just looking at each other like, we might have to leave, because he was struggling as well with the jump scares. And when I got Comfort Mackey's afterwards, I just, like, the main sort of takeaway from it was like, that was loud, and I jumped a lot. Yeah, so what was your first memories of watching this movie?
I saw this movie at a press screening. One of those like ones that's in a little hotel boutique-y screening room, and where they were, you know, handing out buttons and doing the whole PR thing. And my main memory is that I fucking hated it so much that I remember really scrambling to leave, because I did not want to have to interact with the PR who was going to ask me what I thought of the film, because I was like, I have to get out of here before anyone asks me what I thought of this film, and then I need to go somewhere and scream. I just hated it. Like, I've always hated this film, and I don't understand why no one else seems to hate it. I just hate it. And I thought, like, I've never watched it again since. So I kind of thought, like, oh, yeah, no. I was young and angry. I'm going to watch it now, and it's just going to be fine. And literally within, I don't know, like, the first 10, 20 minutes, I was just right back there, like, no, I fucking hate this film, and fuck you, Sam Raimi, and yeah, fuck off. And that's how I feel about Drag Me to Hell. Moving on, no.
Orphan.
No, I hate it because I wish I could say that the reason I have such a visceral response to it is because of the racism, and that is part of it, and that this is a deeply fucking racist film. The portrayal of the Roma woman and all of the, like, quote-unquote gypsy curse business is so fucking racist that I hate it. It even opens with a little, like, scene from the, like, 60s of a child being cursed for stealing some jewellery from the Roma, and you're like, fuck off. I really have to try and be coherent and not emotional in my response to this film. But I think the actual reason why I viscerally hate it so much is that it's so misogynist. This film, I just feel like it hates women so much. And I just feel it in every frame of this film, that this film hates women. Like, partly it hates Mrs. Ganoush for being old and disgusting. Like, the gooiness and gloopiness and the sound effects that they put on this woman who is just old. It's like, oh, her dentures are disgusting. Oh, she has a cataract. She's disgusting. Like, oh, look at her gnarled old hands. Disgusting. A monster. And like, also side eye for Justin Long for continually signing up for films about how old women are disgusting. I swear to God. But, like, the film hates Christine as well. It hates Christine. Like, we see so many things about how Christine is so desperate to make a life for herself. Like, we see her in the car practicing her enunciation because she's trying to lose her country girl accent. We see that she has... Well, basically, we see that she has an eating disorder, that she used to be fat and now she is very thin and beautiful. But that's, you know, only because it plays up her food thing. So there's like a moment where you see her looking longingly into a bakery, and then she has dinner with her boyfriend's parents and she can't eat the food. And all of it sort of played for, like, almost played for laughs. Like, I don't know. There's this whole, like... I can almost read this film about as of being about Christine's terror of becoming this old hag, and how that, like, makes her struggle with food and with her perception of herself. And like, there's even a bit where you see her walking to work in her smart office clothes and she's wobbling on her high heels, like she can't quite walk in them properly. But all of it's kind of, I don't feel any sympathy from the film towards Christine for any of those struggles. I feel like it's laughing at her. I feel like it's saying, bitch, you're trying to be above your station, like, get in your place. And so the film punishes her for everything that she does in order to try and improve her life. Like, we find out that, like, her mother was an alcoholic. Like, she has this incredibly tragic backstory. But it's like, but you're going to be punished because you made one decision at work. And so you are literally going to go to hell for attempting to change your life. I hate it. The film is so cruel to this girl that who's just trying her best. And I don't know. I don't feel like we're supposed to feel any sympathy for her. Like, that he has her murder her kitten, which is, like, obviously unforgivable behaviour. I just feel like this film hates me and I hate it back. So there you go.
Yeah, fair enough.
If Sam Raimi has never had to work in a shitty office, and Sam Raimi has never had to make a decision at work, or he's never had to do anything that he ultimately would rather have not done, good for him. He's only ever, obviously, lived his principles, and he's a perfect human being, obviously. But this can fuck off.
Yeah, I see that.
You can be like, but I did like it. No, I don't like anything about it. Like, I think the CGI is really hideous as well. It's just...
Yeah, the CGI is worse than I remembered it. I remember at the cinema not noticing, and then watching on DVD, like, it is...
So
there's ugly. A couple of moments where, like... Because I love Gloop and Goo.
Yeah, but it's not real Gloop. It's just, like,
no,
CGI Gloop.
Yeah, I think, like, the nosebleed, I still love. Fantastic nosebleed scene. I do like Drag Me to Hell. I think it's one of those films that I remember more fondly than the experience of actually watching it, which I think I get with a lot
that
of...
That happens, yeah.
And I think because I remember, like, the highlights as well. Like, I remember the talking goat during the exorcism scene.
Which I can't even watch because I'm just like... There's just another scene where they're like, oh, well, we'll find a brown person. They know magic.
Yeah,
I fucking hate this film. It's so horrible. Sam, do you know what, though? I'm going to put it out there. I don't think there's a single Sam Raimi film that I love. Possibly not even that I like. I think it's one of those things where when you start being into horror and everyone is like, oh, but obviously The Evil Dead is, like, one of the best films ever. You have to love it. And, like, I've never liked it, but I never felt like I was allowed to say that. I hate it. I hate it. I would never watch it by choice. In fact, I would actively not watch it because I hate the tree rape thing. It makes me feel really uncomfortable and I don't like that film. So.
Yeah, that is a horrible scene that shouldn't be in it.
So yeah, like, I'm a grown up now and I can say from my chest,
own the Sam Raimi hatred.
No.
I do. Evil Dead 2 is one of my favourite movies, if not my favourite movie.
Oh no, we'll have to stop being friends, I guess.
Oh no! Bummer.
That's a shame.
But no, I come at Drag Me to Hell with a lot of Sam Raimi love as a someone who makes chaos.
I like chaos, I like goo, but I don't know.
Yeah, I love chaos and goo, and I love over-the-top camera work and the fact that his horror movies are basically cartoons. Drag Me to Hell, I think, works in a lot of, like, reaction-provoking ways. So, like, I it's tricky because I do see the how mean-spirited it is making the old lady be such a... Especially after she's dead.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's fine. Dead people. Dead people are disgusting.
Yeah, dead people are gross. Yeah.
But you got to admit, like, even before she goes, like, even before she's, like, begging, he really makes sure that she's disgusting at the loan office so that, like, Christine can feel justified in saying no. Like, she's, like, taking her dentures out and stuff, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think watching it again, like, it's difficult. And I think part of my problem with Drag Me to Hell is that I don't think it has a position. It tries to hedge the how much you should hate or like the characters. So I think I do. There's a couple of moments in that lane scene where you feel really sorry for Mrs. Ganesh because she's begging, and she is just an old woman who needs help with the house. So in that moment, it feels like you're supposed to be judging Christine. But then later on, there are moments in the film where it almost feels like it's like, oh, have we been a bit mean? Like, oh, like we don't, you know, you should feel sorry for Christine though. But like also don't feel too sorry for it. And it feels like it kind of goes back and forth. And I think some of the moments, I don't think the script is good enough that it can balance the fact that it wants, I think they want you to understand and feel sorry for Christine and to root for her. But I don't think the script is good enough to balance that with trying to make her someone, you know, like it's the horror, like what would you do to survive a horror movie? Like someone, would you kill your kitten? And she does. And, you know, would you go and do all these things? I don't think it can't figure out how to make her sympathetic and someone you want to root for with the fact that it wants to drag her to hell. Like the whole movie is like at the end of the movie.
We haven't even got to the twist.
No, we haven't.
Whoops, sorry.
It's all right. It's not your fault. We just haven't got to it. There's a cursed object that she thinks she's got rid of by giving it to the. She digs up Mrs. Ganesh's grave and hands it off. However, Justin Long has held on to it because she's got his vintage coin and her cursed button mixed up. So at the end of the movie, she gets dragged to hell. That's the big oh shit ending where she gets literally dragged to hell under the train tracks and Justin Long watches it happen. It's a film that exists to drag its main character to hell. I love the title. Great title.
I will give it that.
But yeah, I really enjoyed this movie as a, if I don't think about it too much, basically as a like ride. As a script and as a film that's supposed to have characters in it, it doesn't know what to do with Christine. I think it's like, I love the You're Dead movies with the exception of the tree rape, but I think one of the reasons why they work so well is that Ash isn't a character. Ash is like a puppet, like cartoon. He's just Bruce Campbell to get smacked around by Sam Raimi holding tree branches, basically, and to like Sam Raimi to throw buckets of blood on. Yeah, I don't think this film works if you try and take any of its characters as actual people, which it wants you to.
Try and take it as reality. As a cat owner, do you think you could kill your cat if a demon was coming after you?
No. I'd probably let the demon get me, to be honest.
Same.
I can't even deny him like going outside when we want to go out. I mean, we can, but that's taken effort.
Yeah.
Like our cat, especially, is a little demon.
Mm.
And I know you know this one too. But yeah, like, I couldn't kill my cat.
No.
I could, you know, hide him or try, but like, would that work?
My cat came into the room when I was watching this film when the kitten sacrifice scene was about to come up and I was like, no, go away. Don't watch.
I do like Alison Lohman's delivery of, I killed that kitty.
Oh, I don't blame her. I think I do blame Justin Long. It's definitely not his fault, but I blame him anyway.
Yeah, I think also, like, I like Justin Long in this, but also his character's like a saint.
Well, except like, he is and he isn't. Like, I think it's partly a tone problem in that Raimi does want to do really gooey slapstick stupidity. And you can't really have that existing in a world where people are having real problems. Are you supposed to think that Justin Long is a lovely person? Or I don't know, he's a bit of a dick.
He is a bit of a dick. By the saint thing, that's an overstatement. What I mean is that Justin Long is presented as, he's a non-believer in everything that's going on, but he sticks with, he looks after Alison Lohman and doesn't question her too much about like her decisions. He's very skeptical about going to see any of the spiritual experts, but and he pays for it all. And but he doesn't have any. His character doesn't have to make any hard choices, really, and doesn't get put through near the same amount of shit. And he doesn't even get like gooed. I don't think he might not even get rained on.
No, that fucker. He had an umbrella.
So I always, I feel like he gets off scot-free in this movie. I know he has to comparatively.
Comparatively. I mean, watching someone you love get dragged to hell is probably quite traumatic.
Probably. It's probably not as bad as getting dragged to hell.
No, absolutely not.
It's probably quite upsetting. I don't know. It's the thing, it feels like it wants to be like a 30s or 40s like horror movie, but it just directly ports over the racism.
Yeah.
So like it feels like it's inspired by the Wolfman and.
Yeah, but then if you look at those movies have so much sympathy for their villains. Even like, look at Frankenstein.
Yeah, God, the Wolfman especially.
Or like Cat People. Like Cat People is a comparison I was thinking about a lot with this film because it has a protagonist who is very vulnerable and trying her best to fit into a world where she doesn't belong and is misunderstood by everyone around her and ends up succumbing to the dark side and ends up dead. And, you know, that's obviously not great. But that film makes me feel like it has sympathy for her, like it loves her and it's a tragedy. Whereas this film feels like it's like a comedy and it's like, ah, ha, ha. She got her come up. Like, even the reveal of the button, like, I don't know. It just doesn't feel as, I don't know. Tonally, I can't get a handle on it. And I just don't like it.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think I've had a really quite strong emotional response to all of these films that we're talking about today, apart from Identity, where I was like, eh, it's fine.
Yeah, there's nothing to really latch onto emotionally with Identity. Yeah, Drag Me to Hell, I think I'm always a bit... it's like I remember it as a highlight reel in my head.
Mm.
And the actual experience of watching it's always a bit more of a bummer than I think it's going to be. But then I kind of forget that and a few years later I'll be like, oh, no, it's Drag Me to Hell again.
No, In this case I'm like, I've watched you twice and I will not be doing so again.
Understood.
Okay, let's do Orphan.
Orphan!
I did have some emotions about this film. So... So we have, we are introduced to a couple, Kate and John, who have two kids, but they have recently suffered a tragic miscarriage and they've decided that they want to adopt a third child. So they go to an orphanage where they meet Esther, who is a very strange Eastern European girl who's about 10 and she's just very prim and proper and... a bit of an outcast, and they obviously fall in love with her and decide to bring her home. However, bad things start happening when they bring her home, and it seems like something might be going on with her, like maybe she's evil. Maybe she's an evil child. Or is she? The worst thing about this film, and I will forever be gutted about this, is that on my way to see it, I saw a tweet that gave away the ending.
Oh,
get off my keyboard, you fucker. Sorry, I've got a visitor. Yeah, I threw Jack out and they didn't know you were hiding under the chair, did they? No. I thought you were going to behave yourself, but here you are. Sorry. So I saw a tweet that just gave away the entire ending. And I think when I saw it, I was like, that cannot be what happens in this film. Like, come on. That is not what happens in any film. And unfortunately, it was exactly what happens in this film. How about you? Did you manage to see it unspoiled?
I did. I managed to see it completely unspoiled. I think I'd read a review that was like 3 stars, really ridiculous, but really good fun. I was like, okay, I think I went to see it shortly after that. Yeah, so I think I basically went through the whole thing thinking, okay, she's evil. Like, clearly she's evil. And when the reveal happened, I was like, what? Yeah, absolutely fantastic reveal. Did not see it coming. Completely taken aback. And it does make watching it again super fun.
Yeah, I think I guess we just need to talk about the twist. So the twist that we find out pretty late in the game, I would say, because like we find out that Esther is doing naughty things and evil things and killing people quite early on, and it becomes a bit of a kind of race against time whether whether Kate can persuade people that her new daughter is a bad un before she kills everyone. Because obviously no one believes her. Everyone thinks, oh no, you're just she's talking crazy. About she's such a lovely girl. It turns out she is not even a girl. She is a grown woman with proportional dwarfism. And she has been passing herself off as a child and being adopted by families. She's done it multiple times, I think we find.
Yeah.
And just killing her host family. Well, trying to seduce the father of her host families and killing them when she doesn't get what she wants.
Yep.
That's wild. That's the wildest twist.
It's so wild. Yeah. yeah, because there's all these like panicked... She's trying to get through to the orphanage where she was. Mm. I can't remember where it was in Eastern Europe, but I think it might be in a couple of different countries.
I was going to say it is a couple because they say Russia at one point, but then I think it's... I want to say Estonia, is that right? I don't know. Anyway, yeah, there's a couple different countries. Yeah, and then she can't get anyone who speaks English, and then she finally gets through to the guy, and she says, like, I need to talk to you about a little girl that I adopted who came from your facility, and he says, she didn't come from here, and Kate says, how do you know? I haven't told you her name yet, and he says, no, you don't understand. We're not an orphanage. We're a mental asylum, and I'm like, yeah! it's wild, this film, like, because while the character is ultimately revealed to be a fully grown woman, and so a lot of the things you see her doing are like, oh, that's not so shocking now because it wasn't a child doing it, Isabel Fuhrman is a child and they put her in some right situations.
They sure do. Man, she's so good, Isabel Fuhrman.
It works.
Watching it, thinking that she's playing a little girl, and watching it, knowing that she's playing a woman, and yeah, like such good evil face, such a good furious face, but also such a good sort of but I wouldn't melt. Like, oh yeah, I'm just sort of adorable Esther, and like I wear old fashioned clothes, and you know, I'm just weirdly good at painting and the piano.
Oh, the piano thing is very funny, where she's like, oh, you have a piano, and Kate's like, yeah, I'll teach you to play, and she teaches her, and she's like fumbling, and then later comes home and she's just like playing, I can't even remember what it is, like Mozart or something, perfectly. Yeah. I think I like the exact point in the film where they give away the fact that she's an adult comes right after a scene in which Esther has drugged her adoptive father, Peter Sarsgaard, John, and attempted to seduce him, which is obviously deeply uncomfortable to watch because she's a little girl and she puts on like a slinky dress and makeup. And that, like, right after that scene where you're like, oh God, they're like, oh, it's all right, it's all right, she's in her 30s.
Yeah. And I think it's the reveal of, it's that whole thing with like UV paint that she's been using that no one can see if the lights are on. And there's this reveal of all these very sexual nudes of her as an adult with Peter Sarsgaard. Just sort of that Peter Sarsgaard finds, which is like, what the fuck?
Well, there's a weird subplot in this film about how sexually frustrated John is, this character.
Because,
like, there's multiple scenes where they get interrupted mid-intercourse. And there's a thing about how he cheated on Kate at some point. I think the slight... Like, so the emotional response that I had to this film was just, like, absolute devastation because it's so upsetting. I find, like reviews saying it's fun and you're like, yeah, it kind of is fun when you think about it as, like, a ridiculous film about this evil child who turns out to be a woman in disguise. But it opens with a nightmare sequence of Kate reliving her miscarriage, but in a deeply stylized and horrific way. It's a really traumatic nightmare. And then, like, obviously she wakes up and it's like, oh, the nightmare hasn't gone away because that is a trauma that you've had. And we find out that John cheated on her, she had a miscarriage, she lapsed into alcoholism, and then their youngest child almost drowned in a pond in the garden. And you're like, fucking hell, like, is this not enough trauma without a murderous child woman coming to get you?
I had forgotten just, yeah, A, how awful that first nightmare sequence is. It's rough stuff. Yeah.
Seriously grueling. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, like you said, just how, like, the first half hour is just establishing, like, life has been fucking hard for these guys, especially Kate. I mean, the movie is almost entirely from Kate's point of view, with a couple of little Esther excursions, doing bad shit with murdering people. But yeah, I think it does clearly set up John from the start as someone who hasn't been very good and someone who should be trying a bit harder to be good. Yeah, so I think when he does get it, it's sort of a bit like, yeah, should have listened.
Should have listened to your wife.
Yeah. But I think because I'd kind of forgotten, because of all the crazy child woman carnage, how much of the movie is about Kate questioning what's actually going on and trying to convince the people around her that not only that that they should maybe be a little bit suspicious of Esther, but also that they should listen to her at all.
Yeah, that she's not gone off the rails, that she's not lost her mind, that she's not a bad mother. And there's a section that, like, again, absolutely wrenching, where we know that Kate has like a greenhouse full of all these plants, in particular a rose that she planted in memory of her daughter Jessica, who was the child that she lost. And she's like so carefully tending these roses that represent her daughter, and then later Esther deliberately cuts all the roses off the plant and presents them to her mother as a bouquet, like pretending that it's a peace offering, pretending it's a nice thing. And like, it's just devastating. Like, she's so heartbroken, and it's just awful. It really hurts. I don't know. This film was like, I was like, why is this film so upsetting? Why am I so devastated by it? Like, it's a very silly premise, but fucking hell.
I think that a lot of it is like Vera Farmiga and Peter Sarsgaard are so good in it. Peter Sarsgaard's got a bit of a Patrick Wilson sort of,
yeah,
like amiable, but not like not paying attention kind of thing going on. But the scene where it's like the intervention scene where he's got her therapist, played by Margot Martindale, who's obviously amazing, are talking to her after Esther's found a bottle because she's bought two bottles of wine in a really rough moment and has poured one down the sink and hit the other one, but she hasn't had a drink. And they're basically coming at her with like, you need to go into an institution, like you need to go to rehab, like it's like, yeah, you're letting everyone down. And it's sort of like, no, it's just, it's horrible.
It's horrible. It's so intensely horrible. Yeah.
It's also so silly and fun. Like, yeah. It's weird.
Yeah, all anyone remembers is like this ridiculously audacious twist. And he's like, but that woman's life is so terrible. Like, how is she going to move on from this?
Just remember Isabel Furman setting fire to tree houses and pushing nuns into the road to get hit by cars.
Yeah.
Threatening little boys with scissors to cut their little dicks off and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. That's a wonderful, wonderful scene. She does such good, like, crazy acting in this film. It's really fun.
She's amazing. Yeah, so good.
Because you're like, how can a child be terrifying? That child is terrifying.
Yeah, it's like, and the costume design's amazing as well. And like, all the attention to detail on like she wears ribbons on her wrists and around her neck.
Yeah.
So they can't see the scars. Oh, so good. Also, two good taglines. You'll never guess her secret. And there's something wrong with Esther. I think there's something wrong with Esther is like a flawless tagline.
Like, that sure is. But yeah, again, it is kind of pretty good at... I wish I had seen it without knowing the twist. I wish I could have seen it without knowing that. Because even when I was like, that cannot be the twist, it was in the back of my head the entire time. And I wish I could have just watched it thinking like, that is a horrible 10-year-old. She's so horrible. Oh.
She is.
The UV paintings are glorious, though.
It's like, yeah, how can this twist get any more ridiculous and shocking? And then it's Peter Sarsgaard sort of druggily staring at artwork of him and him naked, sort of being caressed by it.
Oh, man. I just like all the, like, how she's painted like a portrait of Kate, and then in the UV light it's like she's got like a knife through her head and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, it's she's so painted good. The house, and then under the UV light it's just full of people screaming and burning alive, and like,
yeah, it's on fire. Glorious. Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, because she burns the house down kind of everywhere she goes, doesn't she? It's like Carol, I think it's Carol Roden, the actor who plays the doctor at the institution, does such a good job of, he's got like maybe 2 minutes to distill like an entire plot twist. And it's a great exposition performance of like, we've not got a lot of time. Esther is not a child.
Yeah. No, you don't understand. We're not an orphanage.
Yeah. Here are all the things that you missed. Yeah.
Oh, so good. Yeah. So in conclusion, if Peter Sarsgaard is in a film with a twist, that's a good sign.
Yeah. Peter Sarsgaard is generally a good indicator that you should watch something. Big fan.
Yeah. The tension here is whether my cat is going to climb off the windowsill and, like, launch herself at me or not. I think I haven't seen a film with a really good twist that I haven't seen coming in quite a while. I was trying to think what the most recent one is, and I can't think of one.
I think we still obviously get big twists, and I think it's interesting that Orphan, you know, got a belated sequel, because it feels like maybe people were trying to think about how do we do something like Orphan. It's like the only way you can do something like Orphan is to make another Orphan movie.
Oh, I prefer not to acknowledge that film's existence.
But then, yeah, like with Identity, there's always going to be people wanting to do twists on mental illness that hinge on mental illness. But then Identity seems, like you said, like a very sensitive portrait.
It felt like it was at least trying to be sensitive.
Yeah.
Unlike other films.
Just grotesque film, but in a bad way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like Skeleton Key, like Get Out, like there's, I think, with the twists in like Skeleton Key and Drag Me to Hell, I guess, they're like classic horror movie twists where like those kind of twists are always going to be good. I think the thing that you thought was fine and the thing that you trust not to happen happens.
Yeah.
Always a big fan of that. Yeah, just like, oh, you thought this was going to work out.
Given that it's nearly December, have you seen Last Christmas?
Last Christmas? No. I think I know the twist, though.
Okay, I was going to say that I will say nothing else. But that has a horror movie twist, even though it's a romance. What? It should not. You shouldn't put that twist in a romance. That's evil. It's an evil thing to do. Okay, have we got anything else to say about twists?
Don't think so. I think I just love a silly one. Like, I love a really good one that pays off everything. But I find myself quite happily rewatching films that I know aren't very good but have a stupid twist. Because I love the kind of the showmanship of it, of like,
yeah. Yeah, it's a magic trick. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And who doesn't like one of those?
We love it. We love it. I just want to see a twist that I don't see coming, and the twist cannot be this person has been dead all along. That's worst. The worst. Or these characters are all secretly in hell. Yeah, fucking hell. There were so many of them, and I don't enjoy them.
Yeah.
I think Rika might be the worst offender on that front. We're never revisiting that one.
I think, I don't mind. I don't mind a twist that's been used too many times, but when it's like, the in hell or purgatory thing where it's like, you just gotta like, you know, find your way out. That's been done.
You veto that one. But I would like to see some new big wacky twists, and I would really like to see them without knowing. The problem is, I want to say, oh, recommend me something. But like, if you recommend me something, I'm going to know that there is a twist. I don't even want to know that there is a twist. I just want to watch a film and be like, what the fuck? That's the dream.
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to try and think of a twist at the end of this podcast, but I don't have one. Well, I guess the twist for me during this podcast was that there was a cat in this room all along, and I thought I had removed the cats from the room. But no, there was a cat. That's a big twist. Okay. So we are on X, formerly known as Twitter, at @ChillennialHPod, for now, until the whole site collapses, and individually at Sarah Dobbs and at Jonathan Hatful. And you can email us at chillennialhorrors@gmail.com. Please do rate, review and subscribe, just because those are nice things to do and it will make us happy. And I don't give a fuck about the algorithm. And there's a cat on my keyboard right now, so I hope she doesn't accidentally delete this entire recording. That would suck. And yeah, we might try and watch some Christmas horrors. Who knows?
Yeah.
If not, see you around.
See you next month, hopefully.
Bye.
Bye.